Did you ever find a book that caught your attention so deeply in a way no other had because it changed the way you looked at life? Well, I did, and I'd like to share a conversation I had with the author of that book. Hello, this is Denise Kowalczyk, and welcome to this episode of Between the Covers. I learned about the Book of Awakening several years ago. It's a book of daily affirmations, reflections, and poetry by Mark Nepo. Mark is a philosopher, poet, storyteller, thought leader, and all-around great guy, in my opinion. He visited Portland recently for a reading and a talk about his work and his books, and I had the pleasure of having him join me in the KBOO studios during that visit to talk about his philosophy on living, his new book, The Things That Join the Sea and the Sky, and the book that became a number one New York Times bestseller.
Mark, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
This is such an honor to have you here. I'm going to try not to gush too much. I've been a fan of yours for quite a few years, and it's just such a treat to have you here to learn a little bit more about who you are in the world and the work that you do. So thank you.
You're welcome. You're very welcome.
I just want to touch a little bit on my Mark Nepo moment, and I shared with you a little bit off mic, but I discovered you through Oprah, and, you know, I have to say yay to Oprah because I've actually been connected with a number of amazing people through her sharing you with the world. So I discovered your book, The Book of Awakening, 2014. I think it was, you know, her year-end, you must buy this book list. And I was going through some major life experiences, and it was a gift. And so we have a fabulous library system here. So I put it on hold, and just, you know, a few weeks into it, I had to turn it back in. So, of course, this was a keeper. So I went to PALS and purchased the book. So I've been reading it ever since.
Oh, thank you.
So it's been fantastic. That book has changed my life. Can you share a book that has changed your life?
Oh, my goodness, sure. I mean, the first book that comes to mind is Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, which is a small, amazing novel. I highly recommend it to anyone. And I think, you know, everyone has these books that's one for me that I return to and read probably every 10 years. I've probably read it four or five times in my life. And because I change, and so that I see it with new eyes, and, you know, it's like looking at a sunset. It is the same sunset, but it's not. Mm-hmm. And so it tells me more about where I am and how I relate to these things. But it's an amazing story of self-journey to that common place that we all share.
Thank you. I'm going to have to put that on my reading list. Check that out. So I got to spend a little bit of time with you in the car, which was such a pleasure to do that. When you look at your life experience and as you've been growing as a person, do you find you're a planner more or a fly by the seat of your pants kind of guy? I mean, when you venture to look into the future and you daydream or what have you, do you think, okay, here's my step-by-step process to get there? Or how do you go about that?
Well, so I first need to confess I'm a little OCD. But I have learned to use it because I'm not a planner in the sense of how where I think anything's going. We have no control. Mm. The only thing we control in life is our presence and our absence. And so I've learned ever since my near-death experience with cancer that I have no idea where anything is going, and the only place to go is here. Having said that, I am blessed/cursed with a very organized mind. And so I've learned to have my mind serve my heart. So when I'm in the writing space, which is really a listening space, there are no plans. There is only listening and retrieving and feeling and expressing. And around that, I'm very organized so I can be totally free and not organized in the place that matters.
It sounds like a really dreamy way to live life.
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, my wife, Susan, we've been married for over 20 years, 22 or 3, I should know the exact number, but it's we're in the 20s. And, you know, we're just so simpatico. But when we first were really contemplating, we'd lived together for a while, and we first really said, now we're really thinking about marriage. We didn't have any major issues, you know, to discuss. But the big issue was, you know, she opened the refrigerator and said, now look, if we're going to spend our lives together, I am not lining things up in that refrigerator. And so that was our big issue, you know. Right. And I had, and of course, I had no expectation. This is important. It's a silly story, but it's important. Mm-hmm. I had no expectation that she would. That's my stuff.
Wow.
And this is to extrapolate into our culture right now. This is one of the big, I think, things that's in the way, in the divide between all of us, is how we extrapolate our personal experience into worldviews.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know. No, this is my stuff. No one ever on earth has to do. I'm the one who has to line things up. Nobody else has to do that. So no one, you just take that a step further. No one has to believe a certain way or a certain, or have, you know, extrapolate our fear, for instance. Mm-hmm. When we extrapolate our fear into a worldview, we've now made a whole lifestyle out of prejudice and hate and fear.
You know, that's a very good topic that I'm sure we could spend about 3 weeks talking about. But it's interesting. I mean, in your opinion, do you get the sense that we're getting worse at that, meaning owning our stuff and putting it more out there, that it's their fault or its fault or it's not my responsibility? Are we as a human race getting more like that? Or do you sense in your talks and your teachings and your own reflections that there's hope for us, that we, because there is a benefit, I'm totally in agreement, owning your stuff, understanding personal responsibility in the world. Is there hope for us?
Yes, of course. And so let's back up a little bit as we talk about that, because I think that whatever we are living in our particular time, when we back up, it's part of a pattern, just as the waves at sea, they crest and then they dip, and they crest and then they dip. Well, we as a human sea, we do the same thing. And so if you look back throughout history, there are times when people as a whole have reached out to each other and been more open, and then there are times when people are more closed. And actually, though we have a lot of noise and a lot of attention, because we seem to be at a place where worldwide we're entering a phase where people are being more closed and fearful mm-hmm. of each other, it's not really clear yet which way this is going. It's just that that makes a lot of noise and gets the most attention. So, you know, we in our modern culture, I think, are addicted to the noise of things falling apart.
Mm.
Now, things do fall apart. So I'm not saying, oh, let's ignore that. But at the same time as things are falling apart, things are constantly coming together. But things come together more quietly. And we have to listen for them. And it's the balance that helps us right-size all of this in our lives. So, you know, I think that there is hope. And I'll talk about this a little tonight in our talk, but let me bring this up here, is that as I've been thinking about where we are in our American culture and also worldwide in this kind of populism and this secular kind of isolationism that's coming around again and fear-based living. As I think about that in a large, and it really, you know, frightens me.
Mm.
It frightens me as a, you know, as a person from that's Jewish, from a Jewish family that had my grandparents' generation had members of our family die in the Holocaust. So to think that I never thought that I would ever see Nazis and fascists in the streets of America. So on a very personal level, that really concerns me. And as I back up and look at the pattern, those waves crest throughout history and humanity, so then I start to see, well, where does this fit in? And I think I would talk about it this way. I think if you imagine in the beginning of time, the very first time that one human being realized they weren't alone and they came upon another, imagine one cave person stumbles on the mouth of a cave and goes, oh my God, there's another person in there. Well, I imagine that the person in the cave looked out and said, oh, you're different, go away.
Mm.
And that was the beginning of the Go Away Tribe, based on fear.
Mm. Of the unknown, the uncertain.
The other, right, yes. And so if we look throughout history, when that tribe has asserted itself, what has happened? Well, we can't. Well, if I'm afraid, and as it gets more exacerbated, there have been times in history where we say, you know what, I can't trust that you'll go away. Now I have to make sure you're where I can see you, and I'm going to put you in a camp or a ghetto or a detention center or a refugee camp. And in the real extreme periods of history, we have genocide where we say, you know what, I can't trust you'll ever go away, so now I have to make you go away. Yeah. But let's go back. So the person at the mouth of the cave who realizes there's another, he has a different response, he or she, and they say, oh, you're different. Come teach me.
Curiosity.
Yeah, now that's the beginning, I would think, of the come teach me tribe. And the extent or the manifestations of that are when we, yes, through curiosity, we realize, thank God you're not like me. You know, and you look at people like Plato who said, that we are born whole, W-H-O-L-E, but we need each other to be complete. Part of the Come Teach Me tribe. And the extreme manifestations of that, and we've had periods throughout history of enlightenment where people really work harmoniously together. And you can look at the 300-400-year period in the Iberian Peninsula in what was now Spain, where, you know, Muslims and Jews and Christians all live together and learn from each other. So the most important thing about all this is that we are members of both tribes, depending, and we can switch any day that I wake up with more fear than love in my heart, I can be part of the Go Away Tribe.
What I'm hearing in that, and you've touched on that, and also from reading your books, you're a very curious individual. You're a teach me. You're in the teach me tribe for
absolutely.
The most part, right?
Mostly. You know, I could, you know, depending on how much fear I wake up, mm-hmm. I'm not exempt. I could wind up there, in which case that's when we're more together than alone. And if when I do, I need you to remind me.
Mm-hmm.
We need to remind each other of our better angels.
Can you remember when you really took notice of your curiosity and the joy in having that?
Oh, as a kid, you know, before I had any sense of being a poet or any language for spirit or any or God or any name you want to give to us larger than us, I just always, as a little kid, the world has always spoken to me through metaphor. You know, I didn't even know what metaphor was, but whenever I was alone, I wasn't alone. I would see the wind and it would be going through the trees and it would be telling me, there's a pattern here. Remember it.
And we're part of that as humans.
Absolutely.
And that's what, and you're writing in the Book of Awakening that spoke to me, and I think that'd be a perfect opportunity. I asked Mark, and he agreed to do this, to read one of the thousands of passages or thoughts that I love, and I've dog-eared and highlighted my book. There's one on September 25th, so if you are an owner of the book, you can pull that out and read along, and it is this part.
Is it the 20? Oh, the meditation part?
The meditation part.
So, yeah, this is from an entry on September 25th in the Book of Awakening that's called To Hunt or Hide. And the meditation, and the reason that it took as long to write the meditations for this book as it did the book, because I actually tried each of them out and tried to work them. So they were intended, as you notice in my other books, I always have questions to work with, to walk with, to live with, because I really feel that things only remain abstract if we don't personalize them. And so the question, this is where my life as a teacher and my life as a writer are merging in my books, because I really feel like I want to offer that invitation so that you as a reader can personalize whatever has touched you here. So this is one of those. Close your eyes and breathe slowly. Imagine that what wakes in you has lived forever. that it wakes within a soft and resilient casing of tissue that will take you wherever you want, that you have these delicate surfaces through which to feel wind and see light and sense the spirit of everything else that has lived forever. Now imagine that once awake, you walk in a world where small creatures fly about our heads and sing, where colorful, juicy things grow on trees, that you can eat what grows from dirt. Imagine that there is always water running nearby, that you can wash the tiredness from your face as often as you like. Imagine that once awake, you live in a time where there are others you can talk to about this miracle of being alive, others you can laugh with and cry with, others you can love. Imagine you can open your eyes and dance in a world where water can fall from the sky, that you can open your throat and song can come from it, that you can find the sun and let it warm the flower of you into being. Now open your eyes and receive that it is all true. It is all here. It is all now.
Wow, I love that meditation.
Thank you.
That's on my bucket list. Check. Mark, read that out loud. I just love that meditation. And as you mentioned, metaphor always had a big place in how you looked at life and how you share your life experience. And you also talk about in your books your lessons learned. And I'm very curious, how many times do you have to learn it before it really sticks? Or is it just ongoing and forever?
Both. And yeah. I think everyone has both. I think there are, you know, this is the difference between grace and effort, and which the book, a more recent book, The One Life We're Given, is all about the relationship between grace and effort. So we call it grace or revelation, you know, when we have an aha, when we, and there are certain things that come to us all at once because of great love or great suffering, you know. But effort is revelation in slow motion. Effort is revelation in slow motion. This is where our understanding comes slowly over time, and we have to do it more than once in order to see what it is. This is the whole role of obstacles in life. You know, I love, and you may have run across this in some of my books, because I love the Hindu notion of the deity Ganesh. Now, Ganesh, or Ganesha, depending on how you say it or where you're from, is the provider and remover of obstacles. In Judeo-Christian traditions, we have saints and sages we pray to get us out of trouble. Okay? But what I love about the Hindu notion is it says Ganesh is the provider and remover of obstacles. So that tells us what? It tells us that obstacles are teachers. We don't like them. We'd prefer not. But they're teachers. And once we've learned what it is we are to learn, they remove themselves. Or our eyes see differently and we realize it wasn't an obstacle in the first place. And so this requires us to live things more than once, which we could understand as an initiation into grace. You know, I think this is one of the things about stories. You know, we all know, especially people who are older in our lives, not always just the elderly, but, you know, people who repeat stories. We may even find ourselves doing this. We go to a party and we're telling the same story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we may have a partner or a friend who says, God, you told the same story again. Well, you know, sometimes we're you know, not thoughtful. But more often, I think, we tell stories more than once because they have more in them than we can digest in one telling. And now we are returned. This is what the rhyme, Coleridge's rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, is about. He tells this story over and over and over again because the story is not done with him. And so we, in our patience and love, when someone's telling a story more than once, even if we're feeling impatient, I think our love needs to say, they need to tell it one more time, so let me hear it one more time.
There's something in there because one part of it might have more power at that time, and later another It's like watching a movie, a favorite movie, or reading a favorite book.
Yeah.
Just as you opened up the interview with. It's going to make different sense because you're a different person, and you might have that moment like, oh, that totally makes sense now. Or, wow, I'm still confused about that. Yeah, that's really good stuff. Do you have a sense that you have found your core self after being on the planet for X amount of years now? Do you think you have a good handle on that?
Yes, I do. I do very much. And I will be in the next week, I'll be 67.
So. Wow. Congratulations for 67 years on the planet.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It doesn't seem that long, but it has been.
Do you feel smarter now? Wiser?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I think wiser more than smarter. I think smart is like how sharp a knife is, you know, but wise is what you do with the knife.
Mm.
Yeah. So I think wiser. And I definitely have a sense. I think that I've learned that the journey of self-discovery leads us to that foundation, that center that is actually deeper than any one self, where we touch into the common core of all life. So imagine a mountain, and from a distance we see it step up above the horizon. But as you get closer, you can't really tell where the mountain stops and the earth begins. All of that earth is all one earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the mountain is strong because it stands on the core of the earth. And I think that's the same with the journey of a self and a soul and the core of all spirit. We, as we get to know ourselves, we discover what's solid in us. And then it's not solid just because we're solid. It's solid because, like that mountain on the planet, the soul is standing on the core of all spirit. And so when I go to this is why it's important for us to lean into the life of feeling authentically. Because when I am honest and feel what I have is mine to feel to the bottom of my personality, I trip into the well of all personality. And that, you know, I can mentally glimpse all of humanity. That's not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
When I experience, and I think this is, when I experience the depth of what I feel, I touch into the common center. And that's why I think, like, the Book of Awakening has touched so many people, not because I'm, I often have people share with me, it's so touching that, oh, it feels like you wrote that passage just for me, you know, and that's very touching. And honestly, I'm not that smart, you know, but what it does affirm for me, that means that when I wrote that, I was able to be honest enough consistently that I touched into that common well, so that when you read it, it touches into your common center and we meet there.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your new book. How did it come into being? When did you decide? How did you decide this book needed to be brought to life?
Yeah. So, you know, the books, amazingly, they do present themselves to me. And when I have a vision of them, they're there. Like, mm-hmm. I have to make room for them. I have to start to get to know them. I have to find where they are and fill them out. Like, and so this book about 15 years ago, it's called Things That Join the Sea and the Sky, Field Notes on Living. And it's really a collection of teachers for me that have come through journaling over a 15-year period. I mean, I've journaled my whole life, and we'll talk a little bit about the difference between journaling and a diary. But the journal, these journal entries have been things that have, I think it's one of my most intimate books, although all my work is personal. But this book, you know, these are things that have come to me that have been ahas or dreams or stories or things that have troubled me that, like we were just talking earlier, I couldn't figure out and needed to return and circle to. And so I've taken about 100, I think there's 145, 147 of these over 15 years, and I've worked with them further. I've worked with them further to get as much as I can out of them and to bring them forward. And then I organized them because, again, I was certain that I'm not, because I worked with these, I'm sure that they are things that other people work with. It's mm-hmm. not, they're not just peculiar to me. So then I organized them into 17 sections that are things that we all experience, sections like stopping the noise, unraveling the fear, the strength of our kindness, burning off what's unnecessary, the radiance in all things. Those are all sections in the book. And in the back of the book, this is where my teaching has come in life of as a teacher has come in, you know, because I love questions. Everywhere I go, I ask questions. And we can talk about questions, too, which would be good. So in the back of the book, there's a section that talks about journaling, the art of journaling, guidelines, how to start that if you're interested, and 100 journal questions to get you going, which from my years of teaching. So let's talk a minute about that. The difference, as I see it, between journaling and keeping a diary is a record of our days. It's where we went, who we met, what I got at the store, what time of month it is, what day it is. But a journal is the place where you get to have a truthful conversation with life. It's a place where you get to be in dialogue with everything that's alive in you and around you.
And you can daydream a little bit on paper.
And you can daydream. So this is definitely a tool for the come teach me tribe. Okay. So that's what a journal is. It's where you keep returning to this conversation with everything that's larger than you so that you start to understand your place, your own transformation, the way that you're growing, the way that you're not growing. And that's, so now let's talk about questions for a minute. And, you know, being Jewish, I realize in my 60s, because I'm not a formal Jew, you know, I mean, I was bar mitzvahed, but that was more of a cultural family thing that, you know, my family felt we needed to do it because everybody did it. And, but I've learned since, as I've followed my own inner development and the curiosity of my own heart and mind, that actually dialogue and question is at the heart of the Jewish tradition. So it's kind of interesting that I kind of didn't follow that tradition and found my own way back to it. And so questions really, from my perspective as a poet and a teacher and a cancer survivor, is that in the outer world, in the world of circumstance, questions do have answers. You know, where was the address for the studio today? And what time did we have to get here? And, you know, when I go to the grocery store, I need to know what aisle are cleaning things and that those aren't edible, right? So there are real answers in the world of circumstance. But in the invisible world, in the world of everything that matters, that manifests into this physicality, there are no answers. So we don't ask questions there for answers. We ask questions there to open up relationships. We ask questions the way we would swing a lantern in the dark so we see a few more feet ahead of us. We ask questions the way we would open a door that we would want to walk through with someone. That's how we ask questions. So that questions open up a conversation, open up a relationship, open up an experience. So we can never have too many questions. So, you know, I realized somewhere in my life, as I got older, that if someone says to me as I'm talking, get to the point, I stop talking.
Everyone, our society is in such a rush. When I was listening to you talk about questions, a word that came up is intimacy, right? So
yeah.
When you're asking questions, you're getting really close to each other or to yourself or to something. And we're not really a society that's into that intimacy anymore.
Yeah, and I think, and I'm not sure of this, but I think it might have been Jack Kornfield, and I don't know if this is from the Buddhist tradition or if it's Jack's, but I think it was Jack who said that enlightenment really is intimacy with all things, which says that that's not an understanding. It's a moment of a feeling state, of being so present that you feel intimate with wherever you are and whatever's before you. And I think that's really, this really returns to the sense that there's nowhere to go. You know, I mean, one of the blessings of my life, kind of paradoxical blessings of my life at this point, is that I travel all over, really all over. And when I get wherever I'm going, I get there so that I can affirm for people that there's nowhere to go. And I'm very happy to do it. Now, certainly in the world of circumstance, I did fly from Michigan to Portland yesterday. But once, wherever we travel and whatever we go through, we truly arrive at the same place. And that's what opens intimacy, the depth of that common place. So it doesn't mean that, oh, well, if there's nowhere to go, then I don't have to do anything. I'll just sit here and meditate or watch TV or, you know, no, because I think as we live both in the internal world and the external world. And so part of the human journey is a mix of being and becoming. You need two good legs to walk. You need to be and become. And so we have dreams and ambitions and goals. And this gets back to, do I have a plan? Or do we have a plan? Well, no. You know, it was Winston Churchill who said, planning is essential, but plans are useless. And so we need to be engaged, but hold loosely where we think it's taking us. Because I think all of our plans are simply to ignite the aliveness of our heart. In fact, I think we burn our dreams up to light that fire.
You are such a great poet. Every time you speak, it's poetry that comes out. I mean, I mean that as a sincere compliment.
Thank you.
Has it always been what seems very easy for you to realize your thoughts and your ideas and articulate them that way?
Well, I think in the beginning, I think I've always seen it clearly. But like any young artist in any form, I think other artists will share this. In the beginning, I had the whole work of the craft, whether it's speaking or writing or painting or music, you know, is what do I have to do to get as close to what I'm seeing as possible? And so in the beginning, as an apprentice, I would see, like, say, what I just said about the dreams are meant to ignite or burn to ignite the aliveness of our heart. Now, I might have seen that as a young man and then tried to say it and missed. But I said, no, that's not what I was seeing. So I try again and again and again. And then over time, you know, just like a jazz musician, once they know their instrument, there's very little distance between what they hear and what they play. So now it's kind of the same with me. I think, and this ties into a really true teacher in the arts, really any teacher, is one who doesn't instruct someone to see or express like them, but to help them express the way they see, the way the student sees. So, you know, early on, you know, I had some very gifted poets that I encountered, but they were not really good teachers because they were trying to shape their students into mini versions of them rather than saying, no, well, what was it you were seeing? Get back to that. And in fact, you know, a term used in writing a lot is revision. Mm. Well, we've come to understand that as pruning language so that it becomes as direct and there's nothing excess and it's not extraneous and it becomes as powerful as possible. But revision actually means going back to the original vision.
Right. Isn't that interesting? Yes, that's a very good point.
So when I understood that, then I was able to become my own teacher because actually the vision is the teacher. So now it's about like, oh, going back to the original vision, did I get that accurately? Did I actually say what I saw? Did I actually say what I felt? Was it accurate? And so I've learned now things come out, I think, let me say it this way. I've learned that the more centered I am, the less I have to mess with the words. The farther I am from myself or my center or that common center we've spoken of today, the farther I am from that, the more I have to mess with it. Mm-hmm. So if I'm having trouble one day writing or saying or speaking, yeah, it might be helpful to try again. But more often now I say, oh, I just have to stop and get more centered and look again.
That's a great check-in moment, right?
Right. Forget messing with the words, because if I'm having that much trouble, I'm too far away from the original vision.
You mentioned that you've learned that you're one of your own teachers. Who else are your teachers?
Oh, my goodness. Infinite teachers. So I would say Oprah's one of my teachers by her the largeness of her heart and the profound depth of her honest inquiry. I would say that I had a mentor friend who's now gone. He died at 102 a few years ago. Joel Elkies was a teacher of mine. He was a child of the Holocaust, became a doctor and was a watercolorist. But he was a great teacher. He was so kind and loving. When I met him when he was 80, and so we were friends for 22 years. I never thought I'd have that many years with him. And when I first met him, he was very well known in his fields at the time and very well respected. And I, as I got to know him, I realized no one had really like recorded his story. So I wanted to record, you know, I met with him. We were going to have tea. And I brought out, this is before digital, so I had a cassette tape mm-hmm. recorder. And I put it down. And he said, "What's that?" Now, you have to imagine that Joel was very Jewish, but he was raised in England. He was born in Lithuania, but his father sent he and his sister, sensing the Holocaust, he sent them away to London. So he has a British accent, so he's like a perfect, like just imagine for a Jewish kid, you know, having like a Moses Lawrence Olivier father figure. So Joel looks at me with the tape, he says, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, Joel, I want to record your stories." He said, "Why?" I said, "You're an elder." He said, "Elder Schmelder, turn that thing off." So, of course, I listened to him. I turned it off. And we sat quietly. We had tea for a good 15 minutes. And then he reached over and took my hand and he said, "Now tell me about you. Tell me what you care about." And I learned from him that's what a real teacher does.
Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
I'm sorry not to be able to meet him.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm happy to bring him into the room.
Yeah. You carry him with you.
Yes,
forever.
I do. Yeah.
Wow. So you have your new book, and then you have another book coming out.
Yes.
In this year.
July.
Can you give us a little teaser?
Yeah, that book. Yeah, that book is a very, it's through my lens, but it's a very different book in that it's about... it's called More Together Than Alone, and it's about stories of community, stories of time throughout history and cross-cultural stories of when we've worked well together and what are the lessons from that. Now, I've finished it now is no timing of mine in the time that we're in, because I started this book 12, 13 years ago, and it's been a very... different kind of terrain because I've been looking and listening for the stories, but then also kind of being with and wrestling for the meaning in all that. And so it's now done. I've spent a fifth of my life researching this book, and I'm very excited about it. It'll be coming out in July, and it's very... I'll share a story that actually is connected with Joel that's very important, I think, for our time. So this is a story from his mother. His mother survived Auschwitz and lived the rest of her days in Israel. And Joel told me this story that she never talked about it, as many survivors don't, until the end of her life. And then one day, as if they'd been in conversation about it, she just broke in as if they had been talking about it. And she said... "There were two things that enabled me to survive that camp." She said, "Every day I would hide a broken crust of bread somewhere on myself in case during the day I ran into someone more in need than me. And the only thing I had left was a broken piece of comb. And every day, once a day, I would comb my hair with the broken piece of comb, not to look pretty, but to affirm my person. Now, that is a story of community, of resilience. It's a modern myth. And so that turns into a very personal question for all of us and anyone who's listening to explore, and that is, what is it that you carry every day in case you run into someone more in need than you? And what do you do every day to affirm your person? Because affirming your person and making sure you have one thing that can help others will right-size the fear and diminish the isolation that we're experiencing today.
Yeah. The timing is perfect. I can't wait to read that book.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And then maybe you'll come back to Portland, and then I can interview about that.
I'd love to.
That'd be marvelous. We talked a little bit about curiosity. I wanted to talk to you about wonder. A friend of mine, long, long time ago, we were yakking while we were hiking. And she said, you know, there's no more mystery in the world. We have found everything. There's no reason to wonder. I was aghast. I had a totally different opinion than that. What are your thoughts about wonder? Do we have enough?
No. Wonder is like breathing. You don't wonder to find things out, just like you don't ask questions to find answers. You wonder to stay intimate with life, to connect what we were talking about earlier. So here's a little story that's in the Book of Awakening that tells us the difference between curiosity and wonder. And I can't remember exactly where it is, but it's about a master who sends his apprentice. There's always a master and apprentice. And often in these stories, they represent two sides of ourselves. We certainly can learn from others, but they often represent that deep core of us and the surface problem solver in us that's running around afraid and insecure. So this master sends his apprentice. He says, I want you to sit by the river until you've heard and listened to everything the river has to say. So he's a very serious student, so he goes by the river, and he takes him all half a morning to decide where to sit. You know, he has his little cushion and his blanket, and he has the right, you know, everything, his little chimes. And so he sits right up front at first, but the river is so noisy, he said, okay, now I'm missing something. So now he goes far, and he's too far away. Finally, he sits halfway beneath a willow tree, and he starts to meditate. And after 3 days of silence and meditation, he has nothing but a really bad headache. And just at that moment, a monkey on the other side of the river appears and jumps in the middle of the stream, splashing and yapping and wah! And it cracks the apprentice. He starts to weep, and he gathers his things, and he goes back to his master, and he tells him what happened. And the master gently puts his hand on his shoulder. He says, ah, the monkey heard, you just listened. The monkey heard, you just listened. Mm. So we can certainly, you know, the whole point, we certainly can learn by observing. That's what curiosity brings us to the side of the river. It's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with curiosity. But the end of curiosity is wonder, which is the experience of getting wet. The whole purpose of life is to be in the river, to be in the river. So the monkey heard, the apprentice just listened.
Yeah. I love those stories. Love them. There was another passage or reflection you shared, and I'm not going to obviously quote it perfectly, but it's a master and an apprentice. And the master said, okay, take this salt.
Oh, yes.
So, can you talk about that? Because
sure.
It's such a powerful message.
And this is used
all the time now.
This is actually an ancient anonymous Hindu teaching story. And it's just my version of retelling it, keeping it alive. So this time, a master has a very annoying apprentice because he's always complaining about life. Just yak, yak, yak. And if the truth be known, the master doesn't like the apprentice because he reminds him of himself when he was younger. So the master says to the complaining apprentice, I want you to take a handful of salt, put it in a glass of water, and bring it to me quietly. So the apprentice does this, and now the master says, drink. So the apprentice drinks from the glass of water, and he spits it out, and the master says, what's the matter? He says, it's bitter. The master says, I want you to take the same amount of salt in your hand and follow me quietly. So the apprentice gets the same handful of salt, and he follows the master, who leads him to a lake. And then he says to the apprentice, now put the salt in the lake, which he does. And he says, drink from the lake. So the apprentice kneels down, and he scoops up some water, drinks from it. It dribbles down his chin. And the master says, well, he says, oh, it's refreshing. And the master looks at the apprentice. He says, stop being a glass, become a lake.
I love that story because I use it all the time. It's about context, you know. I had a rough start to 2018. We won't get into it. It was the roughest. But I had to keep telling myself, that is the salt in the glass, Denise.
Yes.
Because life is the lake. And so super, super helpful, impactful story.
So yeah, so this ancient anonymous teaching story, I love them. It tells us through centuries that everyone will have salt. We can't escape the salt of life. Some of us may get a little more or a little less, or we may get it all at once or a grain at a time, but everyone will have salt. But whether we're bitter or not depends on the container we put it in. And so when we are asked, when faced with pain, to enlarge our sense of things, stop being a glass, become a lake. Because what? It will not eliminate the pain of life, but it will right-size it. So now, you know, so even though I tell this story, I've written about it, I know it, does that mean that I'm never a glass? Of course not, because I'm human. So this is what being human is, being a spirit in a body in time on earth. Fear, pain, worry, despair, grief, all of these things say hello by constricting us into a glass. Our spiritual practice, however personal, is how do we enlarge ourselves back into a lake? What are the things, what are the very personal ways, things you read, things you do, people you spend time with, music you listen to, what are the places you go? What are the very personal ways that you stop being a glass and become a lake? Because even when you can do that, you will become a glass again. This is part of the journey of being human. No one is exempt.
We are just about running out of time. Can you believe it? I could sit here for 8 hours. I can't wait to hear you tonight. But my final question is just a small one. Do you feel you've discovered your own truth?
Not my own truth. I think that I have found my way, since we're talking about lakes, I've found my way to the lake of truth. And I think we all find our own way. You know, we could have, you just imagine a lake and all the traditions and all the sages and everyone, whether you're a sage or not, you know, we find our way and then we drink from that part, but we're all drinking from the same truth, from the same lake. We just find our own place where we kneel down and scoop up some of that.
Mark Nepo, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. A joy.
To learn more about Mark Nepo's books and teachings, check out his website, marknepo.com. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Between the Covers. I'm Denise Kovalchuk. Have a great day.